Yeah, or at least the people who are commenting do. The people who hate me haven't bothered to comment, I guess. But yeah, no, I think I like doing that. It's a good chance to get my writing out there to more people, and I mean, as you can see, my nature is I have to keep gabbing about this stuff, and can gab in a room full of 14 people, or have it there where potentially thousands, or I guess potentially millions of people could see it. So that's fun. Okay, so what else? Talk to me about Teddy, about the story. What else do we want to talk about here? Yesterday, were we talking about reincarnation?
Two days
ago. Wait, were you talking about chutes and ladders? And,
yeah.
Yep, good. Okay.
What does gift horse mean?
Ah, gift horse.
Oh, yeah.
So that's one of the phrases that Teddy... Well, it's one of the phrases that Teddy puts in his journal to look up. Apparently he heard the expression. There's an old expression: never look a gift horse in the mouth. Any of you ever heard that? Never look a gift horse in the mouth. What that refers to is when you are buying a horse, you always check its mouth. You look at its teeth, because its teeth are an indication of whether it's healthy or sick and how old it is. Have you ever heard the expression, she's getting long in the tooth? Means someone who's getting old, because as the horse gets older, its gums recede, so its teeth look longer. All right. So never look a gift horse in the mouth. If someone gives you a horse, it's really tacky to go, oh well, like, let me look at its mouth. So then, a later journal entry, after he's apparently looked it up, what does he write? Life is a gift horse, in my opinion. Tell me about that. What does that mean?
Don't judge your life. Just be thankful for what you're
doing. Because what you might, you don't have to be here at all. You know, there's the old saying, I cried because I had no shoes till I met a man who had no feet. How many people spend how much time just stressing because of, what did you stress about this week? You don't have to raise your hand and say, but think about, what did you stress about this week? What were your major problems?
Your math test.
Okay, good, your math test. Your biggest problem this week was your math test. How many people on this planet right now would kill to have your problems? Would kill to trade places with you to have your worst problem as their worst problem? How many people in Darfur would do that? Yeah. Life is a gift horse, in my opinion. You know, I talk about this concept a lot with my guys in prison. You know, how many people in Darfur would kill to trade places with a person in prison in New Jersey? You have a warm, safe place to sleep, 3 meals a day, clean clothes. That's a pretty good perspective. What else? But see, that what keeps people from appreciating the gift horse is just this, no matter how small your problems are, they're your problems and you tend to focus on them. I remember once, years ago, when my daughter was small, and she was going to Pingree, and your friends are always having birthday parties on Sundays. And one Sunday, my wife drove her up to a classmate's house in Short Hills for a birthday party. And when my wife gets there, and she greets the other girls. Mom and says, "Hi, how are you?" And she says, "Oh, today has been my worst nightmare." And my wife is like, "Oh, geez, what happened? Did someone die? Did someone get sick?" She says, "Geez, what happened?" And I said, "I've been waiting all morning for the man to come and fix the electric garage door opener. Yeah. Yeah. You know? But yet, somehow we humans have the ability to, whatever comes onto, whatever problem comes onto our, kind of the screen of our awareness, to focus on that. Okay? So you're a little kid. This is called fixation. Freud talked about fixation. And centuries before Freud, the Buddhist psychology talked about fixation. So my favorite example is when you're little and you know you're going to go to the doctor for your checkup. Yeah, did we talk about this once? Yeah, but yeah, so, you know, a week before, you're saying, oh, mommy, am I going to get a shot? Am I going to get a shot? Now, you're not getting the shot yet, but notice you're already being miserable. This is the Buddha's second noble truth. You create your own misery. You create your own misery with your mind. When the moment finally comes, it lasts about 3 seconds when you're getting the shot, right? You give yourself a week of misery instead of 3 seconds of misery. And when those 3 seconds happen, what percentage of the surface area of your skin is having pain inflicted on it? Yeah, like a 1/100th of 1%. And yet you're doing this. You're putting all your attention on the one part where the pain is and ignoring the 99.999% of your skin that feels fine. Isn't that weird? That's how fixation works. Right, you put all your attention on the math test. Oh, I blew the math test, and you know, and somehow pull your attention away from the fact. I don't even have to think about the fact that I'm going to get 3 meals today. Doesn't mean you're a bad person for doing that, but it does mean that it's very valuable to recognize that. Oh, this is how the mind works. This is how I create my misery, and when I realize how I create my misery, I can stop doing it if I choose to. And that's the Buddha's third noble truth, right? First noble truth, humans experience misery. Second noble truth, the misery doesn't come from the outside. It's not caused by the math test. It's caused by the way we fixate on it. And the third noble truth is good news. If you're creating your misery, you can stop creating your misery. What else? Yeah.
Did he predict?
Yeah, Teddy, because he's such a kind of freak of nature, has been examined by all these psychologists, and they made tapes of all their interviews with him, in which he, among other things, and really seems to sort of regret that, like, the one doctor, the one psychologist, he told him when he's likely to die. That's where the person lived.
Well, no, like, was there any particular reason why he settled in New Jersey?
Oh, why Salinger would make it?
I don't know.
What was Elizabeth, New Jersey like in the late 1940s or early 50s when he wrote this? I don't know. Just a town. But if we're looking at names, what's Teddy's name?
Theodore.
Huh? Well, Teddy is short for what?
Theodore.
Theodore. What does Theodore mean? Theo is God. Dor means gift. Like, you know, Pandora. You said about Pandora in Greek mythology. Pandora. She had all the gifts in that trunk. So Theodore means gift of God. There's a girl's name that means gift of God. Dorothy. Dorothy, Theodore, it's the same thing. Why does Salinger give him that name, gift of God?
He seems to know a lot about
him. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And maybe something else. What is God's gift to us?
Life.
It's a gift horse. Yeah, isn't that interesting? You notice how during the conversation, Nichols, toward the end, Nichols keeps wanting him to, is it Nichols or Nicholson? Keeps wanting to talk further with Teddy, but Teddy keeps going, oh, no, 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 I don't want to be late for my swimming lesson. It's like he really wants to get there. Now, as you're pointing out in the Gospels, you know, it's interesting because people often think, oh, Judas was this infinitely bad person that he, you know, betrayed Jesus, told the Romans where to arrest Jesus, and which led to his crucifixion. But if you read the Gospels, at the Last Supper, Jesus says, one of you 12 will betray me. And the disciples are all going, not me, is it him? Is it him? Is it me? Me? Not me? You've all seen the famous painting of the Last Supper. And if you look closely at the painting, it's interesting because you see Jesus in the middle of the table. 11 of the disciples are, you know, to his left and right. And the one is sitting across the table from him. Judas is sitting across the table from him and a little bit slantwise, and we see the back of Judas's head. And if you look closely at the table, I love this, Judas has just knocked over the salt. He's just spilled the salt. Now, it doesn't say that in the Bible. I think that was Leonardo's invention. But what it does say in the Bible is after Jesus says, one of you 12 will betray me, he kind of leans across the table to Judas and he says, and I quote, that which thou must do, do quickly. You hear that? That which thou must do, do quickly. In other words, come on, buddy, let's get the show on the road. We got a crucifixion to stage. Yes, if it were done when 'twere done, 'twere well, 'twere done quickly. Yes, that's a very good connection, Liz. I suspect Shakespeare, you know, those days everyone heard the Bible. And I think, I suspect Shakespeare had that in mind, which of course makes who the Christ figure and who the Judas figure there in Macbeth. Yeah, and Christ would be Duncan. Yeah, interesting. So in the Gospels, it's very clear that Jesus has a sense of his destiny. You know, it says that the night before the crucifixion, the night before the Romans arrest him, he goes and he prays to God, and he says something. This is one of the most profound things in the Bible, because it's clear he knows what's going to happen. And he says, he prays to God, and he says, may this cup pass from me. Right? And that's reasonable. I mean, you know, crucifixion is a really hard... Did we talk about this? Physically, what happens when you're crucified? This is death by torture. You know, we're so used to seeing the beautiful paintings, and it's so kind of heroic and spiritual and lofty. In actuality, and the paintings, it always seems way high up there on the cross. In actuality, they kept you pretty close to the ground so that the people had to see how horrible it was. Because this was done to terrorize other people, make sure no one else threatened the Roman rule. And they would keep you hanging there, and all kinds of bad things would happen. One thing that happens is you start losing control of your bladder and your bowels, so that urine and feces are just running down the stem of the cross. You'll never see that in the painting, but that's really the way it would happen. And the way, you know how you actually die is you're suffocating, you're drowning, you can't properly fill your lungs, and you're suffocating, drowning in your own fluid. If they really wanted to prolong your torture, as apparently they did with Jesus, they tack on a little board just below your feet so you can just barely press your toes against it and fill up your lungs a little bit, and you know, it takes you longer to die that way. And then generally they would leave you hanging there after you die so that the dogs would then come and start like eating your feet, and the birds would come start pecking your eyes. You know, you see this happen to deer carcasses by the side of the road. Yeah, it was really horrible. So it's very reasonable that Jesus says, Father, may this cup pass from me. Could I please not have to go through this? But then he adds, nevertheless, not mine, but thy will be done. You've heard that, thy will be done? Nevertheless, not mine, but thy will be done. It's like, okay, given a choice, I prefer not to go through this crap, but if I gotta, okay, I'll give it up to you. I'll do whatever I have to do. I think that's a very, can you see that that could be a useful attitude for us? Okay, I prefer not to flunk the math test. But if that's what's in the cards here, hey, it is what it is. So Jesus clearly, when he says to Judas, that which thou must do, do quickly. Clearly he's saying, he's participating in it. It's as if he's a co-conspirator. Why? Why did he do that? Yeah, and Ben, why would it be his fate?
Because like that's like why he was like born on earth to like save.
Yeah. From the point of view of Christianity, is it a bad thing that Christ was crucified?
Well, he rose from the dead, you know.
Yeah, it's absolutely yeah. If there's no crucifixion, there's no resurrection. And there's no salvation. He's like fulfilling his destiny. He's taken his part. This is his part in the movie. And I think that Salinger is very consciously echoing that when he has Teddy keep going. No, I got to get to my swimming lesson. I don't want to be late for that. Now, when he leaves, now watch this. This is the thing that people miss sometimes, and this is important. This is on 197, just below the middle of the page. Goodbye, Teddy says, goodbye, I have to go. This time Nicholson wasn't able to detain him. He started so quickly to make his way through the aisle. Now watch this. It's all subtext. Nicholson sat motionless for some few minutes. Everyone here at 197. Nicholson sat motionless for some few minutes after he left, his hands on the armrests of the chair, his unlighted cigarette still between the fingers of his left hand. Finally, he raised his right hand and used it as if to check whether his collar was still open. Then he lit his cigarette and sat quite still again. He smoked the cigarette down to its end. Then abruptly, notice that word, that's important, then abruptly let one foot over the side of the chair, stepped on the cigarette, got to his feet, and made his way rather quickly out of the aisle. Using the forward ship stairway, he descended fairly briskly. Right, that means quickly. He's in a hurry here. Yeah, what's happened here, Brandon?
He finally realized what Teddy was saying to him. Now he's going to go. He's going to go try.
He connected his like story, like, oh, what if I was to die? And then he was like, oh, I have to leave really quickly.
Yes, yes. Because Teddy's foretold the whole thing as a hypothetical. Let's say my sister is a young soul. She got a lot of anger. Suppose she pushes me in the pool. Suppose this is the day they're cleaning the pool and it's empty. Just suppose as a hypothetical. But the other thing we know about Teddy is that Teddy predicts when people are going to die. And Nicholson, who's there, is the skeptic. You understand Nicholson is us. He's our representative. Because if we heard... When you start hearing all this stuff, reincarnation and people who know when they're going to die and all, of course, we're skeptical. So he's there as us. But then he starts going, wait a minute. What if this is not all a bunch of BS? What if the kid's not talking hypothetically? So then, and you see how cleverly Salinger builds the tension by having... Nicholson get lost and having trouble making his way to the pool.
Why wouldn't he be like...
Look, he takes a whole, like, two paragraphs to have him get to the pool. That's a conscious decision by the writer. At this point, he's like a film director. The pacing is important. You have to... Then you'd be cutting faster and faster, opening the door. Oh, not here, not here, right? To build the tension. Yes, friend?
Why wouldn't they have him running? I mean, this is like kind of a...
Because he's not sure.
Exactly. Exactly. You see, you have to calibrate these things as the writer, as the film director.
I mean, even if you felt like possibly there's a chance of someone dying, wouldn't you kind of run to...
If you had something that's all in his head, if you thought that, you could predict the bourgeois Vulgarians, then you said that if the bourgeois Vulgarians had
the confrontation, or they help save the person, then they could have stayed alive. But if they don't, then they die.
There's generally some reaching out, and if the reaching out is success, then the person, it's not necessarily saving him from dying. It could be, as in the case of Seymour, or in the case certainly of Sergeant X, but in some way saving him,
if
healing him.
If he had said something earlier, it would have been different. If he had realized what was going on.
But let me ask you this. Is Teddy in need of saving?
No.
Teddy's fine. Isn't it interesting that this book begins with Seymour's death and ends with Teddy's death? Almost like a pair of bookends. And that in each case, they go to their death willingly. And yet, what's the important difference? Happy death is, happy death is okay.
He's like dying to move on to something better, and escape something.
Yeah. And Seymour, it's like out of desperation. It's, I can't stand this joint. Let me out of here.
And he sort of sees it as an end rather than like a reincarnation or like sort of the release from the wheel or whatever.
Who does? Remember Teddy's final words to his mother when she wants to give him a kiss? He says, "Not now, I'm tired." Those are the last words she ever hears from him, I believe, in this world. I'm tired. And I have a feeling that Salinger is using that in a bigger sense also. I'm tired of schlepping through samsara. Do you all know this word, samsara? It's like the opposite of nirvana. Samsara means the cycle of life. You know, going through birth. I got to go through puberty again. I got to go through high school and take all those math tests again.
Do we think that he remembers his past life, or he's just kind of like building his education, or building his
Meditation? He knew that his past life was in India.
Yes, he talks about. Did we talk about this in this class? And about the woman. Did we talk about my theory? My theory that the woman
but
who distracted
me. Most people don't really they're not supposed to remember.
Yeah.
But like subconsciously they like kind of. But did, also did, said that during, towards the end you start to get like little flashbacks.
Yes.
Five, so
and it's and in the sutras, which are the transcripts of the teachings of the Buddha, the Buddha talks about when he sat under the Bodhi tree and attained final enlightenment. And that he remembered all his past lifetimes, supposedly.
Whoa.
And there are people. Some of my teachers that I've studied with, talk a little bit about their past life. If you ever come to my house, over the mantle, I have a big calligraphy, Tibetan calligraphy that was given to me and my wife by this person. Nakchem Rinpoche. He's a Tibetan Lama. He's actually from Wales, but he's a Lama in the Tibetan tradition that we used to study with, and he gave us that calligraphy as a gift. And at the bottom of it is his signature, is in Tibetan, but his signature is three lines. So after he gave that to us, I didn't want to bother him with it, so I asked one of his apprentices, why are there three signatures there? And he said, well, this one is his name in this life, and then those are the two previous lines.
Wait, so is the Buddha still like alive somewhere?
The Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, the first Buddha. According to those teachings, no. Once you,
escape.
Yeah, when you would take that's it. It's Maha Nirvana. It's great release. You're done. But in a different sense, I mean, attaining enlightenment means, did we talk about waves and oceans in this class? Okay. So, this is...
We did.
Okay. So we can do it again. This is really kind of the essence teaching.
Classes?
Oh, it's over now?
Yeah, it's a 40-minute period schedule.
No, it's a different.
At 39?
Yeah, at 43.
At 43. And what time is it now?
44.
Oh. Why is the hallway not full of people? Okay, let me. I'll wait till the hallway starts filling up. We'll take another minute. By the way, did I talk in here about some friends of mine and my wife and some memories of past lives?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, the pilot, and I talk. Yeah, my wife and her Tibet memories. Okay, but you know, all that's incidental. This is the thing that's not incidental. We think of what's our experience of life? It's like going to the shore and looking at the ocean. And when you look at the ocean, you only see the surface. You see isolated waves. Every wave is isolated from the other waves, and every wave is finite. It goes just from here to here, and every wave is impermanent. Eventually, it crashes against the shore, and then it's gone. So that's like things and people. Here's a chair. It's finite. It's temporary. It's isolated. Here's me. I'm finite. I'm isolated. I'm temporary. Here's Luke. Same thing. And we get really tired of that, especially when we start seeing our friends start to die crashing against the shore and go, oh, crap, that's going to happen to me. And it's frustrating because we're so small. Everything else is so big. We want to be the king of Scotland or whatever. So we start, you know, stealing crowns or we, you know, setting school records, getting our name on the plaque so we can feel like we're something important and something bigger and something more permanent. But none of it really works in the long run. So then along come people like Jesus and the Buddha and Teddy who say, look inside yourself, look within. And what you'll see is you're something that's not just a great big wave, you're bigger than the biggest wave, you're the ocean. And the ocean never crashes against the shore and goes away. And you're not isolated from the others. We literally are all one. You're the ocean of being. You are the ocean of existence. You are, as I explained in that Huffington Post piece you just read, you are awareness. And awareness is like space. It's like sky. There's no edges to it. Everything else you experience takes place within it. All the finite takes place within the infinite, and the infinite is actually the awareness you're having right now. Only you keep not noticing that because you keep identifying yourself with this stuff within the awareness, like the body. And once you come to experience this, as Jesus put it, the kingdom of heaven is within you. Right? Then you're liberated. So, work on your papers, please.
The girl in the story says she like, bathes everyone in the ocean.